This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
All right, well, let's look at this little sheet just a minute. And did everybody get one? Okay, all right. Hopefully this is not going to be any surprises for you. I mentioned early on about the dates, that's going to be obviously something significant you'll be responsible for on your exam. The other thing you'll notice B there, the blue blocks, the biographical sketches. If you look in the assigned portions of the main text, on this page we happen to have two of them, Martin Bucer and Ulrich Zwingli. I've not given you a long list of names and people I want you to know, but I would like for you especially to concentrate on reviewing these blue blocks in here, some of the most important individuals, and there'll be some short answer questions on the exam about the people that are listed in the blue blocks, okay? So again, just in the portion of the text that was assigned, several hundred pages, review those blue blocks. And then the list of potential essay questions, and notice I have on there that you're able to write a detailed paragraph. So I'm not talking about three pages on each one, but that you could give some significant detail to responding to these questions. But my commitment to you is there are going to be no surprises. If you know the dates, the blue blocks, and could respond to these questions, you'll be in great shape for the exam. I'm not going to give you all 27 of them. I'd have to give you 5 hours for the exam. But I will pick some, probably I'll pick a dozen or so, something in that ballpark, and of those. And so review the. Any questions about that? Yes?
Say, is there a sense of options of choices, like pick, like write 10 paragraphs out of 12 or whatever the numbers turn out to be?
Probably not. Probably I'm just going to pick 10 of them. Yeah, and not give you the choice. I've done it both ways. I might change my mind, but that's probably I'll just pick 10 or 12 of them. So I won't, again, part of my method in this is, and I encourage you to work in groups, and help you and be a time saver, is I want to review the whole course. I want you in some way to kind of review the content of the whole thing, because I think it'll help put some of the pieces together, because we've covered a ton of stuff in here. And if you're like me, if you kind of review the whole, you can kind of go to a deeper level in your understanding. And some things, connections you didn't make before, you'll be able to.
Well, let's return now to our little look at the Puritans. Remember, we finished up talking about the Roman Catholic reform, what we call the Counter-Reformation. We had come back over to look at what began under the time of Elizabeth, what we call the Elizabethan Puritan movement. Last week, we ended up looking at what we refer to as the Presbyterian phase, at least the early Presbyterian phase, with Cartwright and his attempts to encourage the Crown and Parliament to consider the same kind of thing that had transpired in Scotland, to make create a national Presbyterian church in England. And many of them were committed to the further reform of the church. It felt like the Book of Common Prayer did not go far enough, or they had objections to certain portions of it. We talked about all of that last week, so we don't need to go into that again. But remember that when we talk about this Puritan, even the Elizabethan Puritan movement, that we're not talking about a monolithic movement. There was significant diversity. And in this slide that we ended on last week, underscoring the fact that these Puritans, as they met together in conferences, some of the conferences even began to organize themselves along Presbyterian lines. Some of them were more ecumenical. Those of Puritan sentiment that had some differences, especially around views of church government. And it's kind of amazing that issue became such a dividing line for so many of these Protestant Puritans in England. So people had some pretty strong views about whether or not local church autonomy is the New Testament pattern. Okay, local church. And this is where authority should be vested. While there may be an association of local autonomous churches, there's no body that has the right to impose their will or to have influence ultimately over local church. And these Congregationalists felt very strong about this. Even coming up to the time of the Westminster Assembly that we'll look at shortly, there was a heated discussion and debate about these issues, especially from the Congregationalists, pushing for liberty of conscience, because the Presbyterians, being those that had the strong convictions, were convinced that only the Presbyterian form of government, particularly some of the Scots, had a what we call a de jure view, that is, according to law in Latin, or what we sometimes call the divine right of Presbyterianism. Now, that's pretty strong, isn't it? Most American Presbyterians didn't share that particular perspective, but some of the Scots really did hold to that view. This is the biblical form of church government. It's the only form of church government, and their views were just as strong as the Congregationalists. Well, if you think they held strong views, how about the Episcopalians? We have had bishops since the ancient church. Have you never read the early church fathers? It had bishops by the second century. This is the form of government that God has revealed to His church. It's always been this way. We appreciate your perspective. It's wrong. We've always had bishops. We're going to always have bishops. And the crown tended to like that because that hierarchical church structure was a good match with the monarchy. They were very favorable to that. And typically the kings and queens of England during the 16th and 17th century were threatened by both the independents, that's another term we use for the Congregationalists, the independents and the Presbyterians. So the church government issue was a big one, along with other issues that they discussed. And then we're going to look at the emergence as we move into the early 17th century of some of the separatist Puritans who, even these Congregational Puritans, or the Independents as they were called, even though they were strong advocates of local church autonomy, were willing to be a part of the Episcopal structure. As long as, we're given a certain degree of autonomy within our local churches. But the separatists are the ones that finally say, we've kind of had enough of this, and it's just not going to work. The church is not going to reform itself. And in fact, we're of the conviction there needs to be absolute separation of church and state. And that, and even the independents still were in favor of a state church, and they had not come to the same kind of convictions that the separatists had. But close connections between these two in terms of basically sharing a form of church government, but in terms of loyalty to the crown and an established church is where part of the difference. And then many of these separatist groups are, in addition to a congregational form of government, are going to come to Baptist convictions and be in favor of rebaptism and reject infant baptism. So your Congregationalists still didn't have, all these shared a similar view of baptism. Okay, it was the church government. But here, you've got not only the governmental issue, but also the sacrament, or what many of the separatists will begin to use the word ordinance, which is common parlance in Baptist circles today. You talk about ordinances, not the sacraments. Part of that is just, their distinctive moving away from the nomenclature of sacraments, which to them, connotes vestiges of Catholic theology for some of them. Okay, so that's kind of where we came to last week, and let's pick up now and continue on talking about the Puritan movement. Now let's talk about worship, and this was always the fundamental question for the Puritans, to purify worship. And we wonder why Christians still are involved in what we've, I'll put in quotation mark, the worship wars today. I hate using that term. Discussions over liturgical preferences. Maybe that would be better. Because, you know, this that notion of warfare I'd react to. But we all know the sentiment that's there in terms of the ongoing tension over much of what emerges out of this portion of history, at least in Reformed circles, you know, debate going on today about these things. Should worship line up explicitly according to only those things which are allowed by the Scriptures, what has been called the regulative principle? And I'm sure Dr. Oliver covers that in worship. And knowing Dr. Kelly, I'm sure he talks about it in systematics probably too. But that comes out of this this era in their discussions and wanting to be sure that worship of all things is directed explicitly by the Word of God. Now, for the Puritans, let me highlight this point that the sermon is the centerpiece. Now, this is so fundamental to our perception of ourselves as evangelicals. Let's think about that for just a moment. The sermon is the centerpiece of the worship service. This, I would say, above all others, it would be the major shift. You talk about a long-term effect on Protestantism and evangelicalism. I would say that is it. Obviously, in the Roman Catholic tradition, the high point of worship is the liturgy for the Mass, right? Well, even the Anglican Book of Prayer, still, even though, you know, homilies and sermons, and I mentioned how the second Book of Prayer seemed to give the sermon a little more heightened place in the service, still, the Eucharist is the high point of the liturgy, and everything kind of focuses on that. Even though the Anglican Book of Common Prayer was, you know, a step in a more Protestant direction in terms of the usage of the sermon, but the Puritans are really wanting to make that the center. No question about that. And we talked about how the Puritans, you know, would go to their Anglican services on Sunday, those who were Anglican priests. And then in the afternoons, they go out and give their lectures. That's what they were called on Sunday afternoons, where they basically would give biblical exposition sermons to the people because they wanted time just to preach. And part of the complaint that the Puritans are always bringing before Parliament and sometimes to the king is there is not biblical preaching going on in the churches. Too many of the priests are still illiterate. They're not doing a biblical exposition, and the people are not being fed the Word of God. And the Puritans were committed to rectifying that situation. Well, if you think about evangelicalism today, it's very odd. You go to any evangelical church in America, and what is the high point of the service? Let's say in the majority of them, I guess I shouldn't paint with an exclusive brush. It's the sermon, isn't it? In fact, it's so big a deal. There's some evangelical churches, you know, we get in and sing a hymn. Let's get the preliminaries out of the way so we can get to the main event. Some of your more seeker churches have even moved. We're not even going to do the Lord's Supper on Sunday morning anyway. I hate to say it, but it's almost like they're ashamed of the sacrament. I mean, there's a reason why it's a part of worship. Now, I know I'm stepping on dangerous territory here because people have strong views about these things. But to where we've come, just think about the prominent place of preaching, that it is, in some instances, among some evangelicals, almost become the sum total of what worship is. And sometimes singing is not a very important... Prayer often is not does not have a special place in the service. Might have an opening prayer. Or the call, you know what the call to worship in evangelical churches is now, don't you? Good morning. I heard Walt Kaiser say that years ago, and I was kind of intrigued by that. I thought that's kind of funny. He's in the Evangelical Free Church, so he can say that. He's critiquing his own tradition. But anyway, I think you get my point. about that. And it's so often the case, it's interesting to watch the debate among evangelicals. You know how the pendulum of history swings. And there's a bit of a reaction to that. Okay, I thought we were here not only to be edified here, but we're here to worship God. Maybe half of our time or a portion of it ought to be given to prayer and to singing. And gosh, maybe we ought to even have the Lord's Supper more often. I mean, that is discussed a lot. So, the issues that unfolded here are still playing out in discussion. Norman, did I see your hand? I didn't mean to ignore y'all.
How often did the Puritans celebrate? I mean, it says no uniformity, so I guess.
Oh, right, yes, good question. The uniformity in terms of the way they would practice that, it would depend upon the... if there's a Puritan preacher who had an Anglican ordination, and most of them did up at this point, they still did, they would have celebrated the Eucharist on Sunday mornings every week with their congregations as priests. And now, some of them didn't strictly follow the liturgy of the Book of Common Prayer as they were supposed to. And when the bishops didn't push to enforce it, or nobody was tapping on them, they could do that. But no, they were, at least for those that were conformists, they were good, Anglicans in terms of having the sacrament every week. All right, psalms, forms of prayer were scarce. More and more of the Puritans believed extemporaneous prayers were more important rather than just set prayers. So psalm singing, parts of the Book of Common Prayer used, but very selectively. No uniformity on the sacraments in form or regularity. Now this had to do, Norman, this is to your question also. Here, I'm referring to when they separate from their Sunday morning services, when the Puritans would celebrate the sacraments among themselves. Then that's where was a diversity of practices in terms of the regularity. But in terms of the conforming Puritans, what happened on Sunday morning? That would have continued. House meetings, a meeting for prayer. Small groups, if you would. This is an old idea. We're going to talk about John Wesley right about next week, who is the mastermind of the small groups. And he knew how to use that for discipleship. But the Puritans tried to emphasize that too, in addition to home of worship for families, that there was time to do that, and private household devotions, where they would encourage the head of the households to pray with the family and to teach them, that kind of thing. But this certainly was not unique to the Puritans.
Luther's catechism had emphasized the use of, especially his smaller catechism, for the training of children in the home. In fact, there were directives in his catechism that the head of the household is to instruct his children thus. And so it was not an innovation, but it does seem to be a theme. And I've found more and more interest in these things. You find more material published on kind of the Puritan, views of the home, of discipleship, of prayer, that kind of thing. I think they continue to be a fascinating group that attract a lot of attention for a number of obvious reasons. But worship was critical for them, and certainly the sermon. That's a good point, because it was a term that was first used during the time of Cartwright, when he was publishing some of his lists of objections, and it was the first time that the term Puritan was used. But people began to identify, with the movement, and I think really these conferences, as they got organized together to meet for piety, for prayer, and the Puritan preachers to encourage one another in the skillful preaching. It was not a denomination. It was a grassroots movement. It's hard to know what to compare. Well, this is going to seem odd to you to compare it to this, but in many ways I think you could compare it to the charismatic movement in this country in the 70s. It was cross-denominational. There was a common agenda they had for renewal in the church, focused around particular perspectives. Some differences among these groups. I mean, you had Catholic Charismatics, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Baptist. They're all over the place. Wesleyan. And But it was never, there were, in the early 20th century, there were Pentecostal denominations that arose, but the charismatic movement was never a denominational thing. It was a grassroots thing. But what added to this and what gave it the appearance of being more organized than it was is because of the number of Puritans at Cambridge. And that there was a Puritan agenda that was being taught to the next generation of young clergy, especially at Cambridge. And so the movement began to grow, and even though they still had their differences over church government and that kind of thing. And eventually they are going to organize because, and you did, you are going to have, you know, Presbyterian, eventually in England, you're going to have your Presbyterian churches, your Congregational churches, your Baptist churches, and, you know, it's going to be toleration. But that's only going to be after the Act of Toleration at the end of the 17th century that it's officially going to be legal for all these churches to be licensed. And it's really at that point that you can talk about the proliferation of denominations. Now, you had Quakers and all these groups that were illegal, that kind of operated underground. But the Puritans tried to stay just below the radar so that they could do their thing, but still outwardly conform to the church. And, you know, and they criticized each other about that. We're going to talk about Richard Baxter. So many of the Puritans, as you move later into the 17th century, criticized him for conforming too much. You know, you're just too Anglican. And yet he was a leader in the Puritan Party. So they, you know, they disagreed on that kind of issue. You're not reformed enough, brother. Or you're too reformed. You're too Anglican. So don't guess that it was a harmonious group, that they didn't have strong feelings. I mean, that always, those things always took place. These Puritans, they were of the temperament of John Knox. We want to reform lock, stock, and barrel the whole church in every aspect. And they tended to view most things in black and white more and more. Calvin, often when his opinion was asked for by the Englishman during this period, he would say, "Whoa, boy." You know, some of these things, like the argument about the surplus. Okay, is it really that big a deal whether they wear vestments or not? You know, the use of candles. I mean, is that, you know, just because it's not mentioned in the New Testament, does that mean absolutely not? So Calvin had a more moderate perspective on some of these things. And I think many of the reformers in on the continent, because the reformers on the continent, if you take like Luther also, because they are working so close, hand in glove with the state, they are wanting very carefully not to become too radical, because we got to keep things under control. See, in England, the Puritans are bucking against the monarchy. Now, Calvin had his own monarchy. Don't quote me. But he pretty much did there in Geneva because of the independence. Now, Luther didn't. But, you know, Luther was very conservative, and he was concerned for harmony in the German states. He was not going to become to a rat, and it's why he despised the Anabaptists. You guys are messing up a good thing. The reform was moot till you came along, and now all of a sudden we're getting pegged as being radical. So I think the different political environment would be significant also. All right, the Marprelate Tracts. I've probably never heard of that, but this was another one of these attempts to kind of throw the gauntlet down and want to challenge the church to move more and more in a reformed direction. And this particular document was written anonymously. They never did figure out who wrote it. But it was obviously Puritan in origin, and especially a criticism of Anglican polity. Now, for the Puritans, they like to refer to the Episcopalian polity as prelacy. We want to get rid of prelacy, because prelacy is a leftover from the papacy. And they believe that the office of bishop should not be distinguished from the office of elder. and that, that they were not in favor of any kind of hierarchical government in that that sense. Well, that stirred up things again. It precipitated a series of imprisonments and trials of Puritan leaders in the 1580s, you see there. And the charge was, how would you like to get charged with this? Clandestine Presbyterian activities. I think I'd have to plead guilty to that one. Clandestine Presbyterian activities. The Puritan clergy, though, were ably defended by Puritan lawyers and insisted that they had never had any intention of separating from the established church. So you can see the tack that they're trying to take practically here to defend themselves. Well, after 1590, attempts to reform the established church more and more were abandoned. And on the local level, though the local parish, Puritanism would continue to flourish in Elizabethan England. Now, Elizabeth is going to die 1603, I believe it is, and so we're coming toward the last decade of her reign. And usually when we look at the Puritan movement, we think about the 1580s, 1590s is the end of this Presbyterian phase or the initial Elizabethan Puritan impetus to make to change England in terms of the church. But after this time, the Puritan focus tends to be more and more on personal piety, and the preaching not as much opposed to the Church of England per se, but on piety and morals. And that became very important. And it was during some of the oppression of the Puritans at this point, some put in prison and trials, that the independent movement is going to have a fresh impetus at this point. And those that believe that, you know, we're just not going to be able to reform the church. And the term independent is sometimes used of the Congregationalists, but also of these separatists, at least in the early phases of it. And they were believed that they would have to separate themselves. And some of them are going to go to the Netherlands and to Holland, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And eventually some of them even make their way over to this country. So during the last decade or so of the 16th century is when the independents or separatists are going to begin to make their own way. All right, well, James I now is going to become the King of England. And the Puritans now are really excited. This may be our window of opportunity. Remember I said the same thing happened with Elizabeth, 45 years earlier. After Bloody Mary died and Elizabeth comes to the throne, you know, now is our opportunity with the change in the monarchy. And Elizabeth, it became obvious, was going to be favorable to the Protestants. And but now, by Jove, we're going to have a Scotsman on the throne of England. So guess what his theological perspective is supposed to be? An ecclesiastical sense. And back to this chart I think I'd put up there again just to remind you of how the Stuart family, the Tudor family now, had been the monarchs in England, and now a new family, royal family, the Stuarts, and coming down through the royal line in Scotland. This was Mary, Queen of Scots, and James is her son. And in his monarchy in England, and in Scotland, when he was during his adolescence, John Knox had actually preached his coronation sermon in Scotland when he was a young boy, and there had been some Protestant regents that had helped him in his rule in Scotland. But when Elizabeth dies, James is in line for the throne. So he and his entourage are making their way from Scotland down into London. And some of the Puritans actually meet him on the way. They're not even going to wait till he gets to London. King, we got some issues we need to talk about. And this was the infamous millenary petition. And it gets that name because there were 1,000 signatures on this petition which was presented to James I. You know, you have a sense based on James' response to this. He realized, you know, I'm already in trouble. As he made his way into England in terms of, you know, I'm going to have a lot of pressure brought to bear on wanting the church to reform, and he was very nervous, as Elizabeth had been. The millenary petition was actually written by Cartwright. You know, he had not ridden off into the sunset quite yet, and so Cartwright, this very straightforward Presbyterian type, authors the millenary petition, 1,000 signatures, citing the abuses of the church. Some of the things, I think I mentioned them last week, the use of the cross in baptism, the cross upon the forehead of the child, that's not scriptural. The use of the surplice, that is the white linen garment. Confirmation, that's not a biblical ordinance. You don't see that in the New Testament. The use of ring in the marriage, I think I mentioned that last week. The objection was marriage was one of the seven sacraments. And so they still saw that as a carryover from Catholicism, that the ring was an outward sign of this sacrament of marriage. Isn't it funny how time kind of changes? Could you imagine us today wanting to have a Protestant marriage and not have an exchange of rings? People would just be, whoa, what is this? Are you really married? But if you're a good Puritan at this time, you said, well, you know, this is not a good thing. The length of the worship service. Some of them were had questions about profaning the Lord's Day. One thing that became prevalent during James' reign was the encouragement to participate in sports on Sunday. In fact, I'm going to show you a little painting later on of a group of Puritans burning the Book of Sports. Now, if you've been frustrated, why the Westminster Confession of Faith in the chapter on the Sabbath explicitly states no recreation on Sunday, welcome to James I, and the English Puritan resistance to his encouraging activities like this on the Sabbath. That's what that was a reaction to. And in a lot of presbyteries today, you hear voicing of exceptions to that. You know, I'm going to watch the NFL and I'm going to throw the football with my son. But anyway, I don't mean to downplay that, because the Puritans were dead serious about this, and they felt like the Sabbath was sacred. It is the Lord's Day, and that it needs to be set apart for special purposes. And they felt like this was a distraction to encourage the people to be out doing these things instead of spending Sunday wisely. And interestingly, the Pietists on the continent will strike a similar note about the proper use of Sundays. All right, and then reading the Apocrypha and the lessons, and there are other things that they objected to. Well, what James does, he says, okay, good enough, let's have a conference. So they meet at the Hampton Court Conference. This was a palace that had been built by Wolsey. This goes way back, earlier to the time of Henry VIII, this opulent palace. And James invites the Puritans to be there, present their case, and the Anglican bishops are there. They agree to some slight changes to the Book of Common Prayer, but really nothing significant, and it becomes obvious to the Puritans they're severely disappointed. James is pro-Episcopalian, and he's anti-Puritan. James sensed, I know where this is going. We get rid of bishops, the next step is going to be to get rid of the king. And so no bishop, no king. And he felt like one of the ways that he could maintain his authority. And James and Charles I definitely were convinced of this divine right of the monarchy. And they had a very high view of the king. And Charles I is going to take it to such an extreme that for years he didn't even bother to call the parliament. Who needs you? And I'm not going to, and I'm going to, you know, and you know, the English people resented that, and it's eventually going to be part of the catalyst for starting the English Civil War. But these men had very strong views about an absolutist view of the monarchy. And so, and it's part of the reason that you're going to see the major shift long term away from that in England because of the way some of it was implemented. Well, he was opposed to that. Also in that year of 1604, this intriguing incident called the Gunpowder Plot. Now, some of these, we've been talking about Puritans and Anglicans kind of going at it and having their little intramural discussions. Listen, Catholicism was not dead in England. And these people were really frustrated at what was going on. Let me tell you what some of the Catholic nobles did. They came up with a plot where they dug a tunnel underneath Parliament, and over a number of weeks and months, they were able to store gunpowder underneath the building and were planning at a time when James I would be in the Parliament building to blow the whole thing up. In fact, if you go to the Tower of London, they have a great display on the tower on the gunpowder plot. They play it up real big, you know, with the narrator and all that stuff. And they show Parliament blowing up and just everything, and how, you know, London was in disarray and how terrible it was. And then they get to the fine print, but it didn't really happen because they found it out. So, they're kind of messing with tourists, I guess, at that point. But it is true. Someone was caught in the cellar area there where they were trying to get something. It was discovered, and of course, a lot of people lost their heads because of that, if you're implicated as a result of that. But it certainly did fuel anti-Roman Catholic feeling in England, if there wasn't already enough of it. After it was discovered that the Roman Catholics tried to kill men in the Parliament and also the king. And James I, as Charles I will do, probably a rather foolish attempt to impose the Book of Common Prayer on the Scots. Knowing the sentiment of the Scots, that probably was not a very prudent thing to do. But of course he did, because he was Scotch. That's going to be a part of the unfolding story of what's going to take place in Scotland. So eventually, under Charles I, when the imposition of the prayer book is going to be enforced in Scotland, it's basically going to cause a riot, and it's going to cause the Scots and the Puritans in England to join forces against the crown over this. That we're really in the same boat. Both of us are resisting this enforced Anglicanism, and we're not going to submit to it. And so the English Civil War is really born in this attempt to impose Anglicanism.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.